You're listening to the IC Interviews from Investors Chronicle. I'm John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, and in this episode, I've been speaking to the magazine's regular investment trust columnist, John Barron. A former fund manager, John has provided updates on two live investment trust-based portfolios for the Investors Chronicle since 2009, one focused on growth and the other on income. John has recently completed an updated version of his book, The Financial Times Guide to Investment Trusts, Unlocking the City's Best Kept Secret. In this interview, John will explain to me why he favours investment trusts, how the techniques he uses to manage his portfolios have shielded them from the worst impacts of COVID-19, and why he's top-slicing technology and taking contrarian positions in commercial property and commodities. So welcome, John. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, and hope you're well too.
I'm okay, thank you. So you write a regular investment trust column for us. You've actually written a book on it, and I think there's a new version coming out. Tell us, which I've contributed to.
You do?
Tell us what's new in the new version.
Well, it's substantially updated, and it goes into a little bit more detail as to their unique characteristics. But it reminds everybody at the outset that investment trusts are very special investment vehicles, underrated. They've outperformed their brethren, if you like, in the sense of unit trusts and OEICs. And they've outperformed over the long term. They can be a little bit more volatile, but broadly speaking, they're a superior form of investment for those investors looking for pooled investments. And I go into some detail about this, about their various characteristics. And then we broaden it out, the book. Contributors come in and give their perspective, but then we actually put theory into practice. And I share with readers how a real investment trust portfolio is both constructed and monitored by way of example when it comes to the theory.
So you run two portfolios for the Investors Chronicle, and you run some more on your own website. So give us a little feel for how you put your theories around investment trusts into practice.
Well, as you well know, I've been reporting to readers of the Investors Chronicle on two real investment trust portfolios since 2009 now, so it's a good 11 years. But they are, in fact, two of nine real investment trust portfolios that are managed on the website johnbarronportfolios.co.uk. And what we aim to do with those nine is basically five convey an investment journey right from the beginning through to realizing our financial goals. And so as that journey progresses across the five portfolios, they become a little bit more diversified, they yield more, they become a little bit more hopefully defensive in order to protect past gains. And then the other four pursue particular objectives, whether it be a thematic one, objective, a green portfolio, an overseas portfolio, and a high dividend portfolio, which presently yields about 5.7%. So in short, the nine real investment trust portfolios achieve a range of strategies and income objectives. And the two that are covered in the IC have been the longest running, as I say, since 2009. I could go into more detail, and maybe we will, John, as to how we construct those portfolios. But, you know, we aim to invest for the long term. There is a growth bias where income objectives allow. And as that journey unfolds, we increasingly diversify the portfolios. So hopefully they become, and time has suggested this has been achieved, they become a bit more defensive. But we're never complacent, despite the open performance page. And as you've seen from the performance figures in the IC of the portfolios, they've done very well relative to benchmarks. We are never complacent and are, if you like, always questioning our assumptions.
Those portfolios have done very well over the long term. Obviously, the pandemic has come along and perhaps shaken a lot of things up this year. How did your strategies work out during this period of quite extreme volatility?
Reasonably well. I mean, if I give you an example, three, perhaps four of the portfolios now of the nine are in positive territory. They've made gains at a time when the market is down, I don't know, 17, 18% at the moment. And one of the reasons for that is that they have very much a growth bias. So we are overweight to technology. We are overweight healthcare and biotech. We tend to be overweight smaller companies and underweight value stocks. And we still think that growth, despite value having underperformed over the last 10 years, we still think growth is going to do relatively well. So overall, we're pleased. There's been one or two areas where we've been less pleased. You can't have perfect portfolios. But despite outperforming markets, there's one or two lessons, I think, to be learned from this pandemic, including the importance of making sure you've got your diversification in place.
How do you diversify? What's the secret?
Well, as far as we're concerned, we look at, I mean, readers or listeners will understand what diversification is, and that is you're investing in assets that are less correlated to equities in the hope that you protect your gains if there's a wobble in the market. How do we do that? We were early supporters of infrastructure investment trusts. We were early supporters of renewable energy. We also have had gold in the portfolio, physical gold, by way of ETFs. They are predominantly investment trust portfolios, but where there is no investment trust equivalent for a particular commodity we're after, gold being one example, then we're not afraid to resort to the occasional exchange-traded fund. Commercial property has in the past been an area that we've considered useful in the balanced portfolio to achieve an element of diversification, and we know that we could talk about that. But we also believe that diversification can be achieved within the equity market, and as I've said, we've had a bias towards growth technology stocks, biotech, etc., but also growth stocks in general, because we feel, in particularly in these uncertain times, growth will continue to be rewarded, as indeed it has been so far to date during this crisis.
Growth is obviously where we want to be. It's what we want to achieve as investors. But you mentioned income. A lot of investors are looking to create an income out of their investments. But you said that you have a growth bias towards income. Can you explain what you mean by that? Because they don't seem like very natural bedfellows.
No, fair point. I mean, where there is not an income requirement, there is a growth bias. Now, that's not 100% growth. You have to maintain portfolio balance and keep things within a certain structure. But the bottom line is there is a growth balance. Where there is an increasingly income requirement, yes, we introduce infrastructure, renewable energy. Commodities we've recently been introducing, they produce out of favor sector at the moment. They producing a high yield and we think sustainable yield. But you can also, one of the unique features of investment trusts is that an increasing number of them are using their flexibility to pay a decent income out of capital and reserves. Without getting into too much detail, listeners will know that investment trusts have things called revenue reserves. That's one of the things that makes them unique. They can store away income as the years passed, put it into something called revenue reserves. And when there's a wobble in the market, they can pay out of that. But increasingly also, investment trusts are paying out of capital as well, profits, if you like, that have been banked. And that combination is positive. An example, for example, is JP Morgan Japan Smaller Companies, which pays 4% of its net asset value on a yearly basis. Now, that will mean, because the NAV, the net asset value, goes up and down, there'll be a fluctuation in the dividend. But I think a development like that is positive, because they are providing a yield in a market which hitherto had been pretty scarce when it comes to income. So you can both get that combination of capital growth, Japanese smaller companies we think will continue to be a good area to be in, but at the same time draw some income as long as you accept there's going to be a little bit of volatility in the payouts. And Japan, sorry, JP Morgan isn't the only example. We've got Montanaro, UK smaller companies. We've got International Biotechnology, many others. And provided these companies don't overpromise, and we think 4% is very reasonable of NAV, then we welcome this as a good, as a positive development for investors.
Absolutely. It sounds like the total return approach that that's increasingly being advocated as a way to generate income.
Absolutely.
In terms of some of the themes that you mentioned, Japanese smaller companies, you mentioned biotechnology there. Can you talk me through why you are attracted to certain themes, Japan being one of them, for example? I know a lot of investors are slightly nervous about Japan. It has a bit of a checkered history, but you've been bullish on Japan for quite a while.
Yes. I mean, in a way, we tend to be slightly contrarian investors, but let's go with the flow for the moment. I suppose our biggest overweight is growth stocks generally. And that includes technology, biotech, and each of those have their own particular stories, which we can cover if we have time. But we're very firmly of the view that over the long term, and that's what we stress, we're investing over the long term, John. I think it's very important to have the humility to accept that I certainly don't know where markets are going in the short term. I would be misleading you if I inferred I did. But what I do know is that we can add value over time. And if we invest over time, then investors will do very well indeed. And investment trusts have that track record of outperforming not only their benchmarks, but also unit trusts and OEICs, the other form of pooled funds, if you like. Growth stocks, we think, will continue to outperform. I wrote in a recent website and IC piece about Professor Bessenbinder's research suggesting that only a very small number of stocks actually deliver that, most of the market's gains. And they tend to be growth stocks. And that's why it's important to keep a portfolio orientated towards growth. So sectors, technology, biotech, but we're not afraid to be contrarian investors as well, as you well know. And when infrastructure trusts first came on the scene, renewable energy, there was a large degree of skepticism there in the market, as you could see from some of the small discounts on investment trusts. But that sentiment has improved. Premiums have now gone out and often are 10, 15% premiums to NAV. But we still think they provide a good source of income and diversification going forward, and indeed have provided some good growth in the past.
You mentioned Premier there in terms of the price at which you can buy an investment trust. Do you have a disciplined strategy when it comes to deciding when you are going to make your entry point? And I guess the pandemic would have potentially thrown out some interesting entry points, given you know that many of these investment trusts would have sold off to significantly below NAV.
Yes, I think we do have a very disciplined approach, and if you like, stock criteria is very important to us. There has to be discipline. Having said that, there can be a view in the investment trust world that you don't buy investment trusts on premiums. We disagree with that. We think if there's a good track record and we like the underlying market and we speak with the management by and large, we tend to invest in investment trusts. And I can think of, you know, something like Scottish Mortgage Trust, for example, the largest investment trust, which is a FTSE 100 company. You know, if we had not bought or added to positions on a premium before the pandemic struck, then we would have been sorry, because that has performed very well indeed. But by and large, we're always examining trusts and their current value, whether they're standing on premiums or discounts. And we're always asking the question, does an investment trust deserve the premium it's standing on? And I'll give you one example. The renewable energy at the moment, there's a bit of a debate about pricing, power prices going forward. And there are various forecasts out there suggesting modest declines as the years pass. You know, we are looking at that very closely. That is beginning to impact on modestly on NAVs. But we still think, for the moment at least, that renewable energy is a good place to be, given the yields, sustainable yields, we think on offer.
I mentioned trust trading at potentially large discounts as a result of the pandemic. What's your view there? I mean, you yourself mentioned that you take a contrarian approach, and I guess buying something at a significant discount is a contrarian move. You've stuck by some fairly unloved sectors through time, and commercial property stands out as one of those at the moment. Can you talk to me about perhaps commercial property is a good example of how you look at things, perhaps from a different perspective as some investors?
Yes, I mean, the crisis has thrown up a lot of opportunities in some ways. I mean, I will come on to commercial property in a second, but one example is a technology stock called an investment trust called Augmentum FinTech, which went out to a very large discount during the crisis. And we introduced it into the portfolios, or some of the portfolios at least, and now it's back at towards par, but still offers tremendous potential, we think. But commercial property is an area where, as part of our portfolio seeking, those portfolios seeking diversification, we had some exposure. We still have some exposure. And it's been an area that, in some respects, has disappointed. Sentiment is poor. Discounts have widened. But, you know, John, I think it's very important to always question the relationship between sentiment and fundamentals. We all know that, you try and buy investments when sentiment trails the fundamentals, and then question the investment when sentiment is ahead of fundamentals. And it is our view that provided you're careful with your selection, sentiment is trailing fundamentals over the medium to long term when it comes to commercial property. Despite all the bad news out there, people will, in perhaps a modified working pattern, with courtesy of modified working patterns, though, they will need to get back into the office. And so we are taking a cautiously positive approach to this, and particularly looking at those opportunities outside the Southeast, actually. We still think the regions have a lot of catch-up to go. So we're not, betting... betting the bank on it. Every portfolio is balanced in its approach. No particular asset or asset class is too aggressively pursued. But, we still think there's a place for commercial property in a balanced portfolio.
I mean, looking at it from the other perspective, you mentioned, in the case of commercial property, sentiment is very poor. In the case of technology and healthcare, sentiment is very strong. Perhaps it's got ahead of itself. I mean, impacting the way you think about some of your exposures to those sectors, which have actually performed incredibly well during the pandemic?
Yes, I mean, it is, John, in the sense that we have been very modestly top slicing some of our growth exposure, technology particularly, but not aggressively so. We've just been top slicing because they've had such a good run. I mean, some of our portfolios are in positive territory when, as I say, the market is down 17-18%. And we think that certainly smaller companies in the UK could look interesting. And we also think the sentiment is poor there at the moment. You know, when you've had an economic shock, many people suggest smaller companies is the last place you want to be. We think there's some good value there. And we've been, if you like, moving some of this money that we've top sliced from technology stocks into other areas that are presently out of favour. But I do remind you, John, that we remain very much growth investors. That's our bias at the moment. And although we've top sliced, we remain overweight growth. But after 10 years of underperformance, a decade of underperformance by value, there's got to be some value there. But I'd encourage listeners to be cautious in how they try to capture that value, because many will be value traps.
You mentioned UK smaller companies, which is quite a contrarian position to be taking at the moment, given how poorly the UK economy has performed throughout this crisis. I mean, are you limiting your UK exposure? Or are you nervous yourself about where the UK goes from here? It doesn't feel like we're in a particularly good place economically.
I think coming into the crisis, John, actually, the UK economy, relative to other economies, was doing quite well. Now, we can debate the figures, but the bottom line is, broadly speaking, it was doing quite well, and certainly better than some of the sceptics with regards to Brexit were suggesting. I think the important thing here is always to maintain an element of portfolio balance. No matter how positive we're about, we are about a sector, a region, or an asset class, we try to keep balanced portfolios. It doesn't stop us being overweight those sectors we favour, but we're not, as I say, betting the bank or the portfolio on any particular sectors. Now, when I say we're overweight smaller companies, we are. We still think that there's value there in the sense that when an economy takes a shock, value stocks underperform. That shouldn't be a surprise. They're more geared into the domestic economy. They tend to be highly indebted. They tend to be higher risk plays. The quid pro quo of that, of course, is if there was a sustained recovery, then you would expect perhaps value stocks to do better. Time will tell. We don't believe that this is going to be a very strong recovery. We think it's going to be patchy in parts, and therefore you've got to be very selective. But growth, we still think, is the right place to be, because in times like this, particularly in times like this, people will continue to pay up for those markets that they think they're going to do well. And when it comes to smaller companies, coming back to your question, many of these smaller companies now are very global in their reach. We underestimate the extent to which, partly courtesy of technology itself, they're able to access markets and indeed compete with many of their larger brethren on more of an equal footing than they've ever done before.
It sounds like you probably need to take a selective approach to playing a theme like UK smaller companies, though. How do you go about getting that exposure?
I think you back very good fund managers, John. That's the point. I mean, we're blessed in the investment trust space, because we have a disproportionate number of very good fund managers. I mean, taking investment trusts in their entirety, they have outperformed not only their benchmarks. Now, these are averages, of course, and there's exceptions at both ends, but they've not only outperformed their benchmarks, but outperformed unit trusts and OEICs, as we've mentioned before. Now, this is particularly true in the smaller company space, because investment trusts are ideally suited to smaller companies, because they don't have, being closed-ended in structure, they don't have to worry about money flows coming in and out. And that allows the better fund managers to take a medium to longer term view, and together with the use of gearing, back their hunches, if you like, and research. And over time, the figures would suggest that they've achieved tremendous outperformance. So you choose the good fund managers, you keep in touch with them, you keep an eye on the discount and the gearing, and there are always nuances to an approach like this. But by and large, as a sweeping generalization, we are blessed with the fund managers we have in the sector, and investors should benefit from that.
Do you have any particular favorites, as it were, that you use to get those exposures?
Yes, I mean, you will see from the two portfolios in the IC, we have BlackRock Throgmorton Trust, we have Henderson Smaller Companies, which is more medium companies than smaller, but still has good exposure there. We have Standard Life Smaller Companies. We have Oryx International Growth, which has a slightly specialist investment vehicle, but still smaller companies. We have a range of them, because we don't like putting all our eggs in one basket. But these are all fund managers who have performed well over the long term.
You mentioned earlier that whilst your portfolios had performed extremely well during the pandemic, that you had learned some lessons. The question I was going to ask was, has the pandemic changed the way you think about structuring your portfolios in any way? What are those lessons that you take from this very strange period?
Well, I think, I don't want to sound complacent. I think we're broadly very happy with the way the portfolios have performed and the way they've been structured, therefore. I suppose, we've had disappointments. I mean, our exposure to commercial property has been a disappointment in the sense that sentiment is very negative at the moment. Now, we, broadly speaking, are maintaining some exposure to commercial property because we think it's the sentiment trails fundamentals. We've always realized the importance of cash in a portfolio. We consider it a separate asset class. And it comes in particularly useful at times like this. But broadly speaking, I don't want our listeners to think we're disappointed with everything. We are very pleased with our portfolios, and as I've said, you know, three or four of them are now in positive territory, and the others are not too far behind. So there's always lessons to be learned. I think the biggest one for us is always question your assumptions. Never be complacent. Never just go with the flow. I mean, we are really looking at the technology sector at the moment and saying, look, is it fully priced? Is all the good news in the price? But then I would remind listeners of the piece I put in the IC earlier this month about remaining focused on the long term, and Professor Bessenbinder's research showing that actually, you know, you've got to seek those growth companies, because a very, very small percentage in the US is something like 4% of all the 26,000 stocks that he looked at from 1926. Only 4% really accounted for the vast majority, the best performing 4% accounted for the vast majority of those stock market gains. So you've got to go looking for these companies, and we unashamedly do, even though sometimes you can get mud on your face.
You mentioned cash and the fact you treat it as a separate asset within your portfolios. What's been your approach with your cash position during the pandemic? Did you position differently in terms of your levels of cash? Is cash something that you have on hand because you want to deploy it, or are you using it defensively?
Both in a way. As I suggested to you, that of the 9 real investment trust portfolios we manage on the website, johnbarronportfolios.co.uk, 5 convey an investment journey. And during that journey, the cash balance actually builds, because we consider it as a very valuable asset class, both, as you say, to be defensive, but also, secondly, to actually take an opportunity when it comes, take advantage of opportunities when it comes to stock market wobbles. And so we see it in both lights, if you like. And to directly answer your question, we weren't clever enough to stack up on raise cash levels before the pandemic. I think, like most people, we weren't expecting the pandemic. We hadn't factored it into our calculations. But because of our portfolio discipline, and I'm not just saying this, but we have quite a, you know, strict discipline on how we construct portfolios, the cash levels were there for those portfolios that needed to be defensive. And I think that helped. Well, it did help when it came to the downturn, broadly speaking.
I mean, in terms of cash, you obviously don't earn a lot of money on a cash position. And, you know, one cannot see that changing anytime soon, particularly given the amount of stimulus that is being pumped into not just the UK economy, but economies around the world. Is that level of government largesse something that you consider in your portfolio decisions?
Yes. I mean, I should start, and I don't want to sound disrespectful, John, to those many experts out there, but we tend to take expert forecasts with a pinch of salt, and governments you can't ignore. But, you know, there have been many crises previously, and stock markets have accommodated them. Volatility, yes, but accommodated them and moved on. And what we're trying to do with the portfolios is focus on the long term, put together a good quality portfolio that meets investors' remits, remains balanced, has an element of cash, but is not afraid to back contrarian sectors and views. And we try not to get too, how can I put it, beholden to all the various analysis and sometimes noise that is out there. I mean, at the moment in the markets, there's this, if you like, dual influence. You've got the economy in not great shape. Yet, you know, the various metrics, valuation metrics, would suggest that we're going to get a very speedy recovery. I would suggest an element of caution with regards to that latter assumption. But on the other hand, you've got this massive stimulus by governments. Now, do you bet against the Fed? We are just trying to keep our eye focused on quality investments. I think growth is both defensive at the moment because there is uncertainty about the economy, but is also producing its own economic cycle in many respects. Companies are going to have to invest for the future. The marketplace is changing, the landscape is evolving, and technology will be of benefit in trying to capture that. So the two contrarian measures, economy is uncertain, massive stimulus, we're focusing on maintaining portfolio discipline and quality in trying to navigate these waters. And at the moment, we're succeeding to do so. But I stress, we're never complacent. We're always questioning our assumptions.
It makes me think of something that you've written before and spoken about when you've been speaking at events for us, about time in the market rather than market timing. It's one of the things you've often mentioned that really sticks in my head. When you say it, you get this feeling that you know nothing unnerves you in that because you have this mantra, almost a mantra to rely on. Talk us through that philosophy.
Well, keeping it very brief, John, you've heard it too many times probably, and I can only apologise, but keeping it very brief, a very small number of people know where the market's heading in the short term, and sometimes they know it because of luck, or sometimes they're not. But the bottom line is, I think it's a bit of a mug's game trying to predict short-term fluctuations in the market. I know there's a whole industry out there doing it, and my apologies, I don't wish to offend anybody, but I think it's important to approach the market with an element of humility, and that is we don't know where the market's heading in the short term. We may think we know, but we don't. And history would suggest, coming back to your point about time in the market, history would suggest that if you try and time the market, then you usually get punished. In other words, if you try and say, right, I'm going to raise cash levels, I'm coming out of the market by whatever percent, or totally liquid dating a portfolio, there's various assumptions you're taking. One, you're getting the short-term timing right. But secondly, you're also assuming that actually you know when to get back in. And invariably, the various statistics out there produced by Fidelity, Barclays and others suggest that those that do try to time the market actually come off worse. So we adopt the approach, stick with the market, provided portfolio remits allow, and just make sure you're positioned accordingly. I forget the figures exactly, John, but you know, if you'd missed the 10 best trading days, then you would have lost, or 20 best trading days over a 10-year period, you could be down 20-30% very easily. And then that assumes you know when to get back into the market. So all those assumptions, unless there are people out there who think they've got the answers, we just tend to stick with the market over the long term. But do stress and remind listeners and investors and readers of the column and members of the website that actually investment should be considered a long-term objective.
Indeed. That's not to say, though, that you don't make moves in the short term. You know, you're constantly rebalancing the portfolio. Can you explain the difference between that long-term view against what you do on a more tactical basis, week after week?
Absolutely. Well, I suppose it's the difference between strategy and tactics, I suppose, a tactical and a strategic view. You can remain invested in the market, but that doesn't stop you actually making judgment calls as to whether you think a particular sector, region, or theme has had a good run and now it has come the time to top slice, but reinvesting that money in sectors that you think where sentiment trails fundamentals. So you can stay, broadly speaking, with your cash levels the same, but still moving modestly, gently, the portfolio from one sector to the other or weighting them slightly differently in order to what you believe will capture outperformance. And we're not afraid to do that. What we don't like is saying, right, we're going to liquidate half the portfolio because we think there's a wobble in front of us.
Presumably you don't do it too much because that could become a rather expensive process. Charges must be something that you consider very deeply all the time in managing portfolios like these.
Yes, you do. And you try to keep the changes to a bare minimum. And one of the advantages of investing in investment trusts is that you are investing in a portfolio of companies being a pooled investment. and you're trusting the fund manager to be making moves within that portfolio. But you're absolutely right. You try to minimize the changes, but there are occasions when you do need to make changes. You mentioned previously you felt, and I wouldn't necessarily disagree, that in the short term, technology has had a very strong run. So we have been top slicing a little bit with regards to our technology weightings, whilst remaining overweight generally, and recycling that into, well, most recently, commodities, for example, because we think commodities is definitely a contrarian call. There's big discounts there. There's high yields, which we think are sustainable. And we think that sentiment trails fundamentals when it comes to commodity investment trusts. So there's an example of us top slicing technology a little bit, putting it into commodities, whilst sentiment is so poor.
Another contrarian view to end with. Thank you, John. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Not at all. Thank you very much indeed. Take care.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.